Well, last week, if you were here or listened online, we were looking at the tabernacle. We were looking at how God instructed and then the people responded, and how God always goes first. He wants to be at the center of everything. We saw that at the center of the tabernacle, at the center of Israel, he always wants to be the center, because God going first is essential to our flourishing. If you want to have your life flourish, and when I say flourish, I don't mean if you want to see your bank account flush, if you want to see you working in your dream job and having the ability to retire early. That's not what I'm talking about. If you want to see your life flourish, meaning full of God's presence, full of God's purpose, and full of God's acting out through you, if you want to see that, then God must go first. He must be first in your life in order to see that. If he's not, you're going to struggle in one of those areas. In one of those areas, you will feel a lack of something in there if God is not at the center of it all. So as we wrap up looking at the book of Exodus in Becoming Heartstrong, and again, if you're new, we talk about some stuff that doesn't make sense if you don't know who we are. Becoming Heartstrong is our overarching theme for the next 3 years, where we're reading through the Bible as a community. We started in the New Testament, so we understood the gospel, Jesus, and everything like that. And now we're working our way through the Old Testament. And we're only in Genesis and then Exodus now, and then we'll be soon into Leviticus. So we're doing that, and you're free to join with us as we read along, read scriptures each week, attend our different things that we do, our early morning studies or our evening studies, to keep growing in God as we go. But as we have been doing this, we're wrapping up Exodus now. Let's keep in order the right thing, that God goes first. I'm looking at what Israel and us may turn to if God doesn't go first. One word, a word we don't like, idols. Idols. Now, do you remember as a kid, maybe you were like me, maybe when you were in school and it was time to line up after recess. Anybody remember having recess? Getting outside, right? And it was time to line up for recess. Unless you had a really strict teacher that wanted everybody alphabetical or numerical or whatever, what did you do? It was a race to see who could get into the line first to go in from recess. And usually it involved a few elbows getting out, right? And somebody being very upset at the injustice of being elbowed out of first place in, at the front of the line by some evil intruder who took that spot from them at the last second, when they were the one lining up. Maybe they were, the line's right there, and they were standing here, not quite at the front, and then somebody sneaks right in front. Well, the line actually starts here. You left a gap, so I took it, and, you know. But we want to be first, don't we? And sometimes we'll do whatever it takes to get first. Or maybe you're the person that always calls shotgun, right? Do you know what I mean? You call shotgun, you're heading out to the car, you're not driving, and you used to drive. You're used to, like, you're normally driving, and when you're with somebody else and you're not driving, what do you want to do? You want to be in the passenger seat up front, right? And very few people are going to be like regular drivers, people who drive all the time. Very rarely are they going to be like, give me the back seat, please, right? That's just not happening, right? So you call shotgun as soon as, and everybody has different rules about shotgun, when it has to be called, when you can't say it, when you can say it. But you call shotgun in order to sit in that passenger seat, that coveted passenger seat with the extra room and the good view and the air that's blowing directly on you. It's nice, right? Do you know why we call shotgun? Do you know why it's called shotgun? It comes from back in the old days, the wagon days, right? And you'd have a guy driving the wagon, and the guy beside him would be there for protection, carrying a what? Shotgun. So riding shotgun, they didn't call it the term shotgun, riding shotgun. We inferred that on it, but it was the person driving and, or not driving, but riding along, offering protection. Hopefully we're not doing that now. Hopefully we're not. At best, you're the radio jockey and you're picking songs or you're, you know, doing whatever, getting them a snack if they need it. That's the protection you're offering, right? That's it. But we do that, don't we? We're like, I want shotgun over everybody else. My kids love to call shotgun and race for shotgun. They have a whole hierarchy system of who gets to call it, when it can be called, who can call it when other kids aren't present, what can be done. They have a whole, they have rules. They have a rule book about calling shotgun when either Ingrid and I are not both there. It's crazy. But we have a penchant in our flesh to want our disordered desires. We want our desires met before others. We'll race to do whatever we think that will scratch that itch, that will fill that void in order to see those disordered desires in us met, which in reality is just a form of idolatry. And when I say idolatry, I don't only mean idolatry is in a straight swap for God. There's worship of God, and then there's a worship of an idol. I don't mean just a straight shot swap, right? Where, because most of you are, you're here and you're in a Christian church. So you're either at least curious about, exploring, or fully invested in worshiping God, the Christian, Judeo-Christian God. All right, that's kind of where you may have landed in this thing. So I don't only mean worshiping a completely different God. I do mean that, but also I mean this, that we sometimes can say we fully trust God. We fully are all in on God. But there's specific areas of our lives that when it comes to trusting God and giving it all to God, he doesn't really have that place. We were saying this morning, like, make room for God, and that we give all that room to God. But sometimes in our hearts, if we're truly honest, if we're not afraid of who whatever other people are going to think of us or what being exposed will do, we'll say, yeah, Pastor Jeff, in my heart, there's a part of me that has struggles with saying God's on the throne there. Maybe your finances, where you're just like, like, it's so tight right now, and being able to give and do and whatever and saying, God, you have it all, is really, really hard. Because you think, I need to control this, and money becomes something that is right in front of you, and it's what consumes you. Could be your family, could be all sorts of things. Lots of things, different things that in your overarching life, you're like, yeah, totally following God. Absolutely. But there's a specific area of your life where you're like, that, don't touch that one. Don't come near that. Well, let's just avoid the topic on that one because we're not going there. Everything else, though, God's got. Everything else. But that one area, it's tough. We may say Lord of all, but we don't trust him in specific areas. We don't let him go there. And again, all that comes in direct conflict of who God says he is, that he must go first. Now, there's two ways we can look at how God views idolatry, how God looks at this. One's helpful, and the other one is harmful. Let's look at the helpful one first. Now, while most temples, places of worship that you'll go to, they'll all have statues to their gods. They'll be full, they'll be everywhere, people will have them in their homes. But the one true God, our God, does not. Why? Why does he absolutely refuse to have statues or images of himself in places of worship? What do we see about God? Well, in the garden, what does he want to do? He wants to walk with us. He wants to walk in step with us in the garden, to be with humanity. And when he instructs us to build a tabernacle and then later a temple, what goes in the center of it? It's not an image of him. It's not an idol of him, but it's his presence. He's not a distant God that says, here's an image of me to remember me by while I'm distant. He says, I'm right here in your midst. It's my presence that I want you to worship and be involved in, not just an idea of me. His idea is for us to be with him, not worship about him in his presence. Now in Exodus 20, Israel is at the base of Mount Sinai. And Moses, who's leading all the whole nation, God calls him to go to the top of the mountain so he can meet one-on-one with him. Right, God had chosen Moses to be that intermediary between God and the rest of Israel, where Moses had that ability to go and talk and sit and be with God and converse and have back and forth conversations where the rest of Israel was not allowed to go there. They couldn't even touch the base of the mountain lest they would die. But Moses goes up to the top of the mountain, its peak. Now pay particular attention to what God says as he, from kindness, lays out commandments to Israel. God says this, and God spoke all these words saying, I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth below, or that is in the water under the earth. God had brought them out of the land of Egypt, out of a house of slavery. And that first command that he gives them, that he speaks, is this. The command speaks about this. He says, you will be consistently tempted to make, to worship, and to create things that are greater than the creator of the universe. And you'll do that to fulfill your disordered desires. So my first command is, you shall not have anything else before me. In Pharaoh and in Egypt, all of its gods are created things. The land that Israel had lived in for 400 years was full of many different types of gods, a god for every different thing. And making and worshiping them creates slavery, not sonship. And for us, Egypt, by any other name, is also an enslavement requiring salvation and deliverance. If we paraphrase it, God's saying, I didn't bring you out of Egypt only for you to be enslaved again to idols. No other gods before him, and don't worship created things, is how we remain free. So, question. Besides God going first, why was this first the first command? Well, when in Egypt, Israel was surrounded, again, like I said, by a nation that had a God for every occasion, need, season, and reason. And God wanted them to be holy and set apart. And to do so means to rid of anything that may want to rise up in our lives like a God. We worship, what do we worship in our lives? Ourselves, humanity, people, which are created things. We worship money. How much money is too much money? How do you even answer that question, right? How much money is too much money? I'll tell you, it's just enough where you believe you are the provider and not God. That's too much money. The practice of the tithe is meant to acknowledge that God, Jehovah, is the provider. Maybe it's marriage. Maybe marriage is there, but it's just a created thing. It's not an eternal thing. In God's presence, this will all go away. But we hold marriage in esteem. Marriage is something that's so important in our lives. Not to say that it isn't, but it can become an idol in our lives. Maybe it's family. Maybe in your life, it's like family comes before anything. You try to cross me, and all my Christian character goes away because my family. You do anything to my family, and I'm not going to look very Jesus-like all of a sudden, right? Family becomes an idol in our lives where it says we're not going to allow anybody to touch it. But maybe it's our politics or our railing against politics, our conspiracies. Maybe it's our way of living and how we want to do things. Power, careers, sex, sports, hobbies, entertainment, materialism, buying things, all of those things can become gods in our lives, idols in our lives. Again, overarching, we may say, absolutely, I believe in Jesus. I believe he died for me. He's my Lord and Savior. But there's something, there's places, there's things in our lives where they actually rule in different places and not God. And that's not even to mention the enticement we may have to dabble and dive into things that are mystic, horoscopes, or looking for healing in material things like crystals and stones and gems, all of which is really witchcraft, relies on a power that is not of God. Whenever we worship created things, we trust them for salvation and deliverance instead of God. And this is called idolatry. We trust that they are saving and delivering us from debt, from pain, from loneliness, from weakness or insignificance, giving us fulfillment in our disordered desires. Again, when we think of idols and we think of worshiping idols, we usually think of a service like this, where we come, we sing songs, maybe we give a little money, we listen to a message about it, and we go, oh, I definitely don't worship an idol. I don't have another service that I attend to some other god or anything like that. But anything that demands loyalty to it, anything that demands your attention and you obey its rules and its structures versus God's rules and God's structures is a form of worship. Because this hour and 20 minutes that we spend together is but a fraction of what it means to truly worship God. To lay your life before God and say, God, my life is lived out as worship. My Mondays to Fridays, my working life, my everything. God, use me in any and every way possible. In my actions, what I do is a form of worship to you, God. I glorify you by listening and obeying you every day, every moment of every day. Now, I mentioned there's also a harmful way to see why God cares about idolatry. Now, let's open the service up here just for a little bit in a little bit different format. I'm going to ask you a question, and you can shout out some answers to me that you may think are appropriate for it. Okay. What characteristics would you use if I asked you to describe a jealous person? What is your answers? How would you describe a jealous person to me? Insecure. Vindictive. Angry. Lacking love. Anything else? Controlling. Lots of things like that, right? That's how we would describe somebody who's jealous, right? There's resentment, there's anger, there's hostility. They're dealing with some type of inadequacy, bitterness, fear, desire that translates into lust for things, right? Most often, when we're describing a jealous person, none of it is healthy or positive, is it? None. Almost all the time, it is the manifesting of a wound that needs to be healed, a disordered desire that needs to die, that's coming out as jealousy. And here's the thing. What do we do as humans? What do we do? We have a terrible habit of doing something called projection, right? Projection, where we imagine that God must be as we are, right? We project how we do things onto him. We make him in our image. Because in Exodus 20, right after giving that command regarding idolatry, God says something about himself. He says, "For I, the Lord your God, am jealous." I'm a jealous God. Now, based off the criteria of what we just said a jealous person is, what do we think about God often? When God says he's jealous, what does it mean? He's vindictive, right? He's angry. He's lacking love, right? He's controlling. He's all those things. He wants it from us. We think God is jealous like that when we read that. I'm a jealous God. And you're like, whew, don't want to cross him. Because you know when you cross somebody who's jealous, you know knives are out. It's not good. It's not safe. This is where our projection that God must be like we are is profoundly harmful to us. God is not unwell. He is not unhealed. Nor does he have disordered desires in his life. He isn't anything like people who are enslaved to jealousy. He is completely set apart. He is complete and fulfilled within himself. More so, he is the Almighty, the Creator, the Deliverer, the Friend and Savior, Redeemer. He's our love. He's our life. He is the way, the truth, and the light. He is all those things. Why could he ever be jealous of anything like that in a vindictive and angry way? What jealousy means in this context is that God knows who he is. He knows what he deserves. He knows why he created us and where he should be. And if we give glory, honor, veneration, or worship to anything else, he, in his perfection, demands what is due to him and to him alone. Now, some of you guys may be sports fans here. Maybe this illustration will help you on that one. Hockey playoffs are happening right now, right? We've got a Canadian team that just may make it into the finals. Basketball playoffs are on right now. What would it look like as the season comes to a close and those final teams play for that championship? What would it look like for all the accolades, the trophies, the prize money, the parades, and the worship and adoration that fans will give them? What would it look like if in that moment, when it's all said and done, all of that is given to the worst placed team in the league? Right? What would it look like if that happens? What would it look like if all of that was given to the Ottawa Senators? Oh, no idols, right? Don't take offense. I could have said the Montreal Canadiens. Oh, hey. Right? How much worse is it to describe anything like that to anything other than our Lord? Right? We would think of that as a big injustice. They worked so hard. They earned it. They deserve it. Why would you give it to the last place team? Why would we give anything else to any idol instead of God? Why are we willing to give things to dead things, to things that cannot deliver what they promise? And yet we constantly go, God, I could trust you with this, or I could put my faith in my marriage, or my friends, or my family, or money, or my career, or my retirement plan. Those are the things that are going to bring me satisfaction, fulfillment in life, not God. Why do we do those things? It's our disordered desires where we cannot delay our gratification. And even in saying that, I was thinking about that this morning, about we need to delay the gratification of being fulfilled, because there'll be one day where we're all in the presence with Jesus and we are complete in him and all of the problems of this world fade away. If we delay our gratification until that moment, won't it be so great? But then I corrected myself. God says, abide in me now. That my presence is here for you right now. That you don't have to wait until then to know what it's like to walk with your Creator, to have such intimacy in personal connection with him. It can be right now. But what does that look like? That looks like daily making sure there's no idols in our lives. Daily laying down anything and everything that could come between us and our Creator. Daily laying down anything that says, this is the way you need to go, that isn't what God told you. That's hard. But that's the way that God calls us to. That's the way. God's command is clear. No idols. God's character is clear. There's no one like him. And God's heart is abundantly clear. Worshiping created things only brings enslavement. If we fast forward a couple of chapters in Exodus 32, when the people saw that Moses delayed to come down from the mountain, the people gathered themselves together to Aaron and said, "Up, make us gods who shall go before us. As for this Moses, this man who brought us out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him." This is so key for us to grasp. We are prone to creating idols when what we want most is delayed. When we don't have what we want right away, what do? We look for it somewhere else. In disobedience and selfishness, we turn away from waiting on God to find what we look for elsewhere. You desire intimacy with God. What happens? You try day one, down on my knees, praying, doing my early morning devotions. Check. It's feeling a little better. Day two, yeah, check. Day three, yeah, check. Going like, whew, day four, I'm not really intimate with God yet. What's going on? I'm like, I don't feel like this, oh, this presence in the room. You know, there's no fire by day and cloud, or cloud by day and fire by night in my life. What's going on? I'm not doing miracles like Spider-Man. Everybody gets a miracle. These things aren't happening in my life. Day six, whew, this is kind of tiring. Maybe I'll get up a little bit later and worship, you know. Day seven, it's like, 2 weeks in, the habit of going, God, you come first. God, you come first. God, you come first. The habit of God coming first is gone, and we switch to something else. Something else takes that place of going, this is my get up and go. Maybe it's coffee first and going like this first. Maybe that's what's first, getting your brain going and moving in the morning. God doesn't go first. Follow it up with what happens in that situation. So Aaron says to them, take off the rings of gold that are in your ears, the ears of your wives, your sons, and your daughters, and bring them to me. So all the people took off the rings of gold that were in their ears and brought them to Aaron. And he received the gold from their hand and fashioned with it with a graving tool and made a golden calf. And they said, there are your gods, O Israel, who brought you out of the land of Egypt. Where did they get that gold from? The slaves in Egypt, where did they get that gold? Well, if we remember when we read it, what did God say to them? Ask for their gold as you're leaving. Ask for your gold, their gold and treasures and riches. And they just freely gave of them. The Egyptians freely gave of them as they left. God put it into their hands. The very riches they had as a nation came from God putting in the hearts of the Egyptians to give. Just like they did, we often get hazy on the details, don't we? We get hazy on the details of where our blessings came from and how, who worked for them and how we got them. They're just there and we take them, forgetting how we got them through God. Especially when it suits our disordered desires. It's what has been a consistent cry of the Israelites the whole time they were in the desert, was it not? Take us back to Egypt. We want to go back. We want to go back to where we were. Not only are we prone to creating idols when what we want most is delayed, we're also prone to ascribe to them power, which is God's alone. Now listen to what God had said again in Exodus 20, He said, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of a house of slavery. And again, what Aaron just said in 32, these are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt. It's so much more than just interesting what we see. It's what's revealing is what our hearts do and how easily we can be deceived. Where God Almighty has rightly defined their slavery, they wrongly misidentify their freedom. See what Aaron says? Yeah, these are the gods that brought you out of Egypt, forgetting about the slavery part, forgetting that they were enslaved and it was not an easy life, and that every male child among them was being killed because there's too many of them and they want to control the population. Forget about all that. Let's just go back there like it was like a vacation destination. Forget about that. Your idols do not want you to know that it's actually slavery, that you're enslaving yourselves to them when you choose them over God. But that's exactly what we do when we choose anything other than God in our lives. It's a trademark characteristic of idolatry. Its goal is always slavery. When it becomes an idol, the money that gives us freedom becomes a master that drives us. The career that fulfills us becomes the taskmaster that demands all. The marriage or spouse that we could have in good and godly unity, it drowns us as a source of happiness and fulfillment found in them alone. Sex can be no longer just a God-given bond between a husband and wife, but a hunger that wants to be fulfilled any way possible. Entertainment, our sports, our hobbies, our gaming, our watching, our scrolling, our shopping becomes our hiding place instead of God. The dabbling we did becomes a stronghold in our lives that we are desperate to be free from. We see this in our lives, the lives of our family, friends, or coworkers. A path that temporarily fills those disordered desires, but leaves us empty and enslaved, far from our purpose to glorify God. In the story that we read, what happens next for Israel, we call intercession, where Moses intercedes on God's or on Israel's behalf to God, his covenant people. John Goldingray puts it this way: Moses knows that prayer doesn't change who God is, but God's will is not always inexorably fixed, meaning it can't be changed. Intercession can move the heart of God. Today, Jesus intercedes on our behalf, that we may hold strong in our faith, that we may worship God alone in spirit and in truth, that we would look to God, the author and the finisher of our faith, that he will be faithful and he will provide for us everything we need to live a godly life. So today, in this room, in here, right now, the questions before are this: what idols might you have in your life, in your family, in the church, or even nation? What idols are there in those places? Number two, what is tempting you to look to it for what you need? What is tempting you to look to it and say, I can provide for you that thing that's like right there that's bugging you right now? If you just turn over here and focus on me, I'll fulfill that for you. What outside of God is tempting you to turn to it? Number three, what does it look like for you to cast them down? in our hearts when confronted with these things. We'll find reasons and excuses for acting on our desires. Just like Aaron, a little later, when Moses confronts him, what does he say? He says, man, they just came at me with gold, and I threw the gold in the fire, and out popped a calf. Is what it is. Like, what am I supposed to do about that? Unfortunately, that's how we do things, isn't it? There's a disordered desire in our hearts to turn away from God in some area of our lives. And then when it's time to address it and look at it, we're like, hey, like, I don't know how I ended up here, really. Like, it was really beyond my control that I ended up here. Really. It was us. Want to be honest with ourselves regarding what and how something may have taken place that only God should have. Whether it's shame, whether in our brokenness or whatever, we want to just pretend like everything's okay. Like, I got it under control. They're not really gods or idols in my life. They're not really taking that place. God is number one in my life. But when we're honest, say, God, do you have everything here? We ask him that. God, is there any area of my life that I'm trusting, not in you, but in something else? I'm leaning on you and not something else. It is my vice or my way of coping instead of you. It is what I turn to when I'm in need and not you. God, will you point out something in my life that is tempting me to look to it rather than you? In a moment, we're going to take communion. But before this, I really want us to take a look inwardly at ourselves. Take some steps to dismantle those things that may be capturing our hearts. To be able to look at those things, see them, and take a first step. What does it look like to dismantle that in your life? This is only a first step. To lay it down, to cast it down, here is a first step. Because it'll need a second step and a third step and a fourth step in every day following, where you don't pick that back up. Where you don't say, I threw it down on Sunday, but I'm picking it back up on Monday. When everybody else isn't around, I'm going to pick that thing back up and I'm going to trust it instead of God. It's a process that we walk through saying, God, you have redeemed me, you have me. Everything else I die to. I die to the flesh inside of me. I die to those disordered desires so that you can live in me, God. That you, your presence, can be everything to me. When you came in, you were handed just a little piece of paper or a couple little pieces of paper when you came in. Now, this is going to be tough for some of us. But what I want us to do, if I invite you to do, is to do this. Is take one of these notes that are available to you and write down what has been or is contending to be first in your life in some area. No matter what it is, that isn't the one true God. Take it, write it down on this page. And then as an act of worship today, you don't have to put your name on it. Don't put anything else on it other than what is trying to capture your heart. Capture a part of you that isn't God or godly. As an act of worship today, I'm going to invite you, as we sing that song, Make Room Again, I'm going to ask you to come and just lay it down at the altar here at the front of the stage. Anywhere along the front. You can take it, you can crumple it, you can fold it, you can do whatever. I'm not asking you to go like, this is what it was, everybody, and expose yourself. I'm not asking you to do that. I'm not trying to out you in front of anybody. not, I promise you. What I want us to do is to take an actual step. To say, God, I'm not only just listening, your Holy Spirit isn't only just convicting, I'm responding to you. We don't do it often here, but there's specific times where we have to make choices. And today, I believe for some of us, there's going to be choices where God is saying, it's all of me or it's not. I don't abide with other gods. I don't share space. So it's all of me. Give it all to me. Entrust it all with me. Cast down those allegiances. Let them die at the foot of the cross and reaffirm that there is only one true God in which you serve. So as they sing, we're going to make time to reflect, write down, lay down anything that God brings to mind. God, expose the deepest, darkest places in our hearts. Expose the things in us today, God, that are not of you. Expose the places in our lives, God, where we rely on things, created things, material things, people, and not you. Yes, you use people and you use things. But God, we can tell the difference between when we rely on them rather than you. So God, convict us, not in shame, but to draw us closer to your presence where we can abide in you and with you, and we can learn to grow and walk in step with your Spirit. Give us clean hands and a pure heart today, God. Take time just now as they sing to reflect, and as you want to, you can come up and lay it down, and then we'll have communion.